Okay, time to go on to the next set of questions. Go ahead.
This question is for Dr. Marcus. I was wondering, in your beginning statement, you talked about how the resurrection narratives have both the components of historical memory and then later elaborations of the early church. I was wondering if you'd be bold enough to try to parse that out, and if so, how would you avoid committing the same fallacy that the quest for historical Jesus did by extrapolating everything that was too early church and too Jewish to determine what exactly is in the center?
Thank you.
The last part of the discussion seems to rest on epistemology discussion. Can you both maybe give us a definition of what you're talking about when you talk about evidence and data?
My question is a little bit different. If we could prove decisively, which we can, that the resurrection did not occur and was not real, in what way would Christianity still be meaningful as a movement or not, and why?
Okay, let me take them in reverse order. If the resurrection did not happen, how much of Christianity can be put back together here? I'm going to have to agree with Paul on this one. 1 Corinthians 15:12-20. If Christ has not been raised, your witness is vain, you're lying, you're still in your sins. This is just Paul's list. Verse 18, your loved ones who died in Christ have died in vain. Verse 19, we are of all men most miserable. It's kind of rough. But listen, we haven't given our backgrounds or where we come from. I come from 10 years of searching, debating with Christians, debating with everything religious that moves, and wondering if there's any basis for anything. Coming from a more skeptical basis, and I told him during the break, I respect his position. I have colleagues who would say similarly about faith. I don't disparage it a bit. If that's good for him, that's great. It's not good for me. If I don't know there's a basis, I don't have any reason. If you could tell me authoritatively, if we knew for sure, I think that's the way you worded it, except we have proof, that Jesus has been raised from the dead. First of all, I don't think there is such a thing. But either way, I've already made that clear. But if there were proof that Jesus was not raised from the dead, I'm looking for another philosophy. That's just my background and my approach. A question about evidence and data. I use the marriage analogy a couple times because I think it's not a horrible analogy. All analogies break down. But I think when we say I do, we make a commitment, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, sickness and health. And my wife passed away when she was 43 years old. These things happen. We make commitments. But I think the wise person makes commitments based on asking questions, experiencing, learning. And now maybe we just have a difference on what we call data. But I think we need to know what we base our faith on. And I wouldn't base faith on hope or faith on faith. That sounds a little circular to me. I don't disparage anybody else who does that. But again, I'm going to go back to the data. Was that about it? Okay.
Thanks. Well, yeah, I think, as probably has become painfully evident, I'm not a philosopher to the extent that my worthy opponent is, or even you are. Sorry, I didn't mean that to be condescending, but I guess it came off as probably condescending. I know that there is this whole realm of philosophical inquiry called epistemology, and I'm not an adept in it, and I think I'd like to talk to you about, you know, sort of what are my presuppositions about words like evidence and data. I aspire to be a historian, however, and there are big questions in history, you know, about the degree to which one's presuppositions shape the results that one comes up with. I think it's a dialectic. I think your presuppositions cause you to lead in a certain direction, but I think that there is also just the hard reality of the world out there and memory that sometimes causes you to change your mind. But I mean, I'd really like to talk to you about that. I think the question about how to decide what's historical and not in the gospel accounts is, you know, is a very difficult one. And, you know, I don't, I can't give you like statistics, you know, like it's 50% history and 50% theology. And, you know, that's not what you're looking for. But what you're looking for really is criteria for deciding. And I guess, you know, thinking about what I did with the resurrection appearance accounts in my opening remarks, you know, I did notice ways in which the themes of the particular resurrection accounts in each gospel cohered with themes that one sees distinctively in that gospel. And so it seems to me that that's a pretty good indication that we may be dealing with the theology of the evangelist. Whereas when there are things in these accounts that don't seem to come out of the theology of the particular evangelist, then maybe, you know, you can be safe in affirming that that is, that may be historical. Like Joseph of Arimathea, you know, why is he remembered? Doesn't seem to have a symbolic name. Doesn't really play a role in, you know, the other accounts in the later traditions. Now, that, but I don't think that it's only those things that, you know, don't have any theology in them that are historical. There may be a lot that's historical, but it's, you know, a question of how you can decide what's the bedrock. You know, that's what the quest of the historical Jesus is about, because it is aware that these gospels are this confusing and wonderful fusion of memory and later insight. But, you know, trying to unravel, you know, what's what is difficult, and it's an art, and everybody's going to disagree. Yeah, finally, if the resurrection wasn't real, would Christianity still be meaningful? Well, I suppose it would be to some people, but it wouldn't be for me. You know, I came, as I indicated at the beginning, you know, I came into this because some sort of strange and radical experience, which tore me out of my old life and into this new life, and that had certain consequences in terms of relations with family, for example. But on the other hand, I would, you know, I would answer differently a question that I remember talking about 20 years ago when I started teaching, and that was, I think there was a novel that was about the discovery of Jesus' bones somewhere in Palestine. Archaeological dig discovers some bones, and they were reliably identified as the bones of Jesus. And the question was, would that make a difference for one's faith? And, well, I think, yeah, it would make a difference for my faith, but I think it wouldn't destroy my faith. I think it is still possible to believe in Jesus' resurrection, even if one thinks that his bones moldered in the grave. That's not what I think historically, but I would be comfortable with it if it was shown to me to be historically true. So that's not exactly the question that you asked, but it's the question that I answered. So
I think Professor Marcus is correct to point out that an empty tomb would not lead to belief. However, John and Peter in, you know, went into the tomb, and the tomb was not empty. As the grave clothes were still there, the body was gone. And some of us are convinced that a couple of grave clothes are still in existence, which shows some very remarkable evidence of what may have happened there. And you know, so that we feel that you know, we may have some evidence to look at, but maybe related to this specific event.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, I think, Dr. Marcus, you're kind of starting to then answer, I think, a question I've been having, because I think early on you made, I guess, what I thought was a provocative statement, only you didn't say that this was a provocative statement, so maybe I started to doubt myself. You talked about how The empty tomb accounts, they rest on a historical foundation. They think belief in resurrection would be found possible if the tomb were not found empty. So I guess I'm curious about the semantic range of resurrection for you, and maybe then related to that, what do you think of N.T. Wright's comment that it's necessary for an empty tomb to be connected with these appearances for people to conclude not just that the dead Jesus was appearing to them, but that he had also been raised?
I want to talk about how this, you both talked a little bit about how this faith and scholarship connection affects the quality of your scholarship or affects the way you do scholarship, whether you feel a problematic in the divide of the two, whether you feel a problematic in the fusion of the two, such that you, where the pitfalls are, and even whether you maybe think that there are that one is a worse scholar for having faith be so much a part of the question, or a worse scholar for having faith not be so a part of the question.
Okay, who wants to start off?
Go ahead, Gary. Yeah.
I started last time. But I'll do it again as a favor to you. I'm taking questions reversing it. No, I don't think my wanting to go after this historically and maybe, I don't know, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but if Dr. Marcus says, no, I'm going to put more emphasis on faith, I don't think that makes somebody a worse scholar than somebody else. I think if you look down through history of Christian thought and history of thought in other religions, you're going to find a range, a wide range in the same question. I don't think anybody makes themselves non-Christian or less of a scholar to cite faith and hang on to it right there, or to say no unless I have evidence. I mean, we have differences between us. I don't think that says anything about he's bad and I'm good, or I'm good and he's bad, as far as scholars are concerned. And I
just me being good in one of those.
I think you guys weren't listening, and I had myself good in both. I've told them before. I talk about this sort of thing regularly, and I don't have an issue with. I have an issue with me believing without grounding, but I don't have an issue with him believing without grounding. That's his business, and you know, I think if he wants to do that, that's fine. He's right. He made the comments about not being a philosopher and so on, but then he made a very wise comment. I think virtually all of our beliefs are based on presuppositions. Most of us, not always, most of us are going to end up where we started at the end of the day. Most of us are going to start there. I would just say, though, that just because we end up where our presuppositions, we end up where our belief may have been ahead of time, with maybe slight verifications here and there. That doesn't mean, though, that because I may end up where my presuppositions started and he, from his viewpoint, I still would say, though, that they have evidence, not proof, but they have evidence for conclusion is better than not. Even if I'm going to end up on that side, I want reasons why I'm there. I won't disparage his view to the contrary, but that's still where I'd end up on your third question. To me, it's not a scholarship thing. The second question was addressed to Dr. Marcus. So Alan's question, the first one, is implications of, if you haven't caught this with having him in your vicinity here, there are three of the world's leading Shroud of Turin experts are in your backyard here. And he's been studying this for 20, 30 years, and I would encourage you to take a look at some of this stuff. If you haven't heard the latest information on a Shroud of Turin, it's not the latest, but one of the most incredible deals is that if you're the kind of person who says, well, as of 1988, this thing was laid to rest with carbon-14, I would just say two things. Have you heard about the other carbon-14 testing that put the Shroud at plus or minus 200 AD? I wonder how labs can do that sort of thing. But anyway, I mean, so far off. But secondly, more importantly, the chief chemist for the research team in the 1978 to 1981 investigation, Los Alamos chemist by the name of Ray Rogers, recently published in a peer-reviewed chemical journal, his findings that the two threads that were taken from 1978, the one that was carbon dated in 1988, are chemically different cloths. His conclusion is that the thread that was dated, the little portion of the patch that was dated in 1988, is largely a medieval patch. There's many medieval patches on the shroud, and it's a medieval invisible weave built into the cloth. So if your indication is to say, well, no, that's ridiculous, it's medieval because of carbon 14, I think that reason's been taken from you. But I mean, I still think it's worth looking into, for sure.
Okay, well, I don't know about the Shroud of Turin. I guess I've just assumed that it was a medieval phenomenon. But you may prove me wrong. But I guess what it seems to me that it does attest to is partly what we've been talking about here is just this longing for some concrete proof and concrete sign, you know, that this great event has actually happened. So I guess it's not as important to me as it is to Gary, you know, whether or not it's authentic. But I don't know, and I haven't looked into it, and it's one of the things that I take the privilege of not having a strong opinion about. About the semantics of resurrection language, I hear what you're saying, but I do think that ancient Jews could talk about rising from the dead without necessarily implying by that that the body rises with this other part. And I think this is one of the fatal flaws in Tom Wright's big book on the resurrection, is that he rides roughshod over the contrary evidence, and there is contrary evidence, for example, from the Book of Jubilees, where in one passage it talks about, you know, somebody rising up from the dead. So it's using resurrection language, but their body was still in the grave. So, you know, somebody could distinguish between the rising of the soul or the spirit and have that not necessarily imply that the body goes with it. That's a possibility for an ancient Jew, and maybe Paul is one of those ancient Jews, because it does seem to me to be interesting that the same Paul who doesn't tell us about the empty tomb narrative also distinguishes sharply at the conclusion of 1 Corinthians 15 between a spiritual body and a physical body. So could he hang loose to the empty tomb narrative or not mention it because it was immaterial to him, because what was really important for him was the spiritual body? It's at least a possibility, it seems to me. And then your question, which I think is very interesting, and it's one that I think about a lot. You know, what is the relationship between me as a Christian believer and me as a historian? And does the believer have an advantage, or does the disbeliever have an advantage? And it seems to me that both have an advantage, you know, in different contexts, even for the historical work. That, you know, if one does have, you know, a positive relationship to the material, if one doesn't hate it, and there are, you know, a lot of people in the guild who do hate it, you know, let's be honest, you know, who come out of very conservative backgrounds, which they found repressive, which they've been fighting against ever since then. And so, you know, what they're trying to do in their work is to deconstruct this simplistic version of the faith that was given to them. Now, I do think that they have a role, and, you know, I can't remember who it is that Albert Schweitzer says this about, maybe Reimarus, but he says, you know, he was really motivated by hate, and his hate made him see some things very clearly. And I think that's true, you know, that one, people who aren't part of a group can see some things that are true about it, and that are true about its history, that those within may have glossed over. On the other hand, if you love the history, and say in this case, if you love the church and you love the stories, that also enables you to see some things which those who don't have that sort of relationship to the material may not see. So, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, there's room for both, and both are necessary. But I guess, you know, in this sort of context here, you know, it is important for me to emphasize, you know, that those who have approached the stuff with skepticism, they've been very, very important. And, you know, they have blazed paths that basically almost all scholars are walking on now. So that we shouldn't disparage their contribution. But, you know, I mean, for me, it's a struggle. And I don't want to ride roughshod over the evidence because of where I'm coming from. But I also don't want to give up my strong feelings about the stuff. And negotiating that, I think, is a process that, you know, you'll be involved in the rest of your life. And I will too.
I'm going to take a couple more questions. There's Robert up back here, Tom down the front. I'm going to take you.
This question is for Dr. Hayes. My question is, are you arguing that Jesus rose from the dead, or are you arguing that Jesus was raised from the dead? Because the two of them are not the same arguments to make. At least reading your work and William Dean Craig's work shows that at least you do allow some natural theology to come into the picture, because at least in Pauline theology, Paul argues that if Christ did not rise from the dead, not only is all preaching vain, but we have also spoken something, we have also had a false witness about God, because we said God did something which God did not do. So in that, you would have to argue based on Paul that Jesus was raised from the dead, and not that Jesus rose from the dead, which is what N.T. Wright does, when he argues that Jesus rose from the dead, because N.T. Wright, as a historian, he does not want natural theology to come in. Now, talking about evidence, how do you go about seeking evidence if you are arguing that Jesus was raised from the dead?
I'm interested in the pastoral question, and I'm not exactly sure how to phrase this, but Dr. Marcus, if you became convinced someone in your office was not going to come to faith without evidence or data, what is the best presentation you could give? And Dr. Marcus, if you became convinced that someone was in your office was not going to believe, Dr. Habermas, that someone was not going to believe no matter how many books of data that they read, what would you be left with? If you had someone in your office who you became convinced was not going to believe without any kind of data, what is the best case you could present to them about data that might lead to them believing?
I guess I don't think that I would do that. You know, first of all, I wouldn't let them in my office. I mean, you know, I think if I were to enter into this area, you know, probably I'd be doing something like Professor Habermas is doing. You know, I'd make his sort of arguments. But I don't think that those sort of arguments are, you know, with all due respect, worth making. You know, it doesn't seem to me that, you know, showing the evidence for the resurrection is where it's at. So I have difficulty entering into the spirit of your question. And I don't want to do it. But I'll talk to you later.
Okay, first question, natural theology. Yes, or natural revelation. I think it does play a role. And I think you entertain arguments wherever they're made, and you accept them or reject them. And to the extent that natural revelation has something to contribute, which I think it does. I don't emphasize it all that much, but I think it does have something. I will tell you, when you mentioned Tom Wright, and you say he doesn't like to go that way, I told the group this afternoon when I was lecturing that I've had the privilege of being at all three Cross and Wright dialogues. I participated in the last one, and I'll tell you what, he had several philosophers responding to him. And after he heard about the third one, he got up to the microphone because he was supposed to answer their questions. And I'm serious, this is a quote. He said, Now, everybody thought he was joking around, but he was very serious. He said, I hate philosophy, and I hate philosophers. Because, you know, we're pushing a little bit on that subject. I'm going to say I think natural revelation is relevant. And I think if there's something that comes in there, I think near-death experiences are very relevant. I think wherever you have data, you want to meet it and explain it and move on from there. Now, the second question, did you reverse the question that you asked Dr. Marcus when you asked me?
If you became convinced that someone had read as much data mm-hmm. as possible, and they still were not going to believe, what would you be left with as far as convincing them or bringing them to faith? Throwing data out.
If they throw it out?
You've been convinced that no matter how much data you give them, they're not going to accept your data. What would you be left with?
Well, I mean, I think at some point, by the way, there are a lot of people like that. One of the areas I work in is the area of religious doubt. And I've been working with a clinical psychologist, the same project I talked about earlier. We've been working on this for about 20 years. And by far, the greater grounds for believing or not, for most people, is emotional in nature. And they reject for emotional reasons, too. So I would talk to a person if I got to a place with them where I was, you know, they've given me their response and I've given their, you know, and I've done what I can, I would try to speak to them, pastorally. I don't have any problems with that. And I've already said I don't have any problem with somebody saying, well, I think faith needs to play a really important role here. I mean, I'm not averse to doing that, but I think for me, I can't make that move myself. Here, how's this for an answer? Here's what I'd say to the fellow. I'd say, you need to check out the appendix on the empty tomb in Dr. Marcus's new volume 2 to the book of Mark that hasn't come out yet, because there's about 6 or 7 pages here, and he's really good. He really is. I told him this over dinner. He's very good, and he entertains several naturalistic hypotheses. He gives reasons against all of them, and he ends with a provocative comment. Maybe the reason the tomb was empty is because Jesus had risen bodily from the dead. Now, he doesn't say he's got proof of that or anything else, but he says, maybe. You know, it's possible is what he says. They could read this 6-page deal if they have some questions. But I mean, here's my point, more seriously. You can't force anybody to believe something. You can't. Just like you can't force anybody to say I do to somebody. I go back to that analogy. You can talk, and you can reason, and you can, when they're hurting or when they've lost a loved one, you can come along beside them and try to hurt with them. You can do those things, but you're not going to meet everybody's needs all the time. And I think I have to guard against the possibility of saying, it's my fault somehow if you don't come over to my view. I don't think you have to come over to my view. I mean, I try, but if he's not going to move over to that, I think that's his right. And I don't mean to be harsh, but I mean, people will make their own decisions.
Dr. Marcus, I'm interested in what the soldier at the tomb and other discrepancies do for the tomb narratives, in particular because is it discrepancies that give reason to doubt that an event happened, or consistencies that give reason to believe that it happened? Like, I don't know, say for instance, someone ran through the lecture hall and back out of the door, but everyone in here couldn't agree on what color the shirt was that they were wearing. Does that necessarily mean that it didn't happen?
Of course, you know, the question of, you know, testimonies disagreeing, even if people have seen the same event, that is relevant. And, you know, I think that I started out my remarks by saying that I think it's probable that the empty tomb, that there's some basic historicity there. I think it's improbable that there was a guard at the tomb. So I guess I'm adopting your principle, you know, that what all of these accounts, and I think that, you know, they are, you know, there's at least 2 independent accounts here of Mark and John. They agree on something, namely just the fact of the empty tomb. And, you know, through weighing all the pros and cons, it seems to me that that is more probable than not. On the other hand, I think that it is that the guard at the tomb, which is only in Matthew, is a weaker testimony because only one person has it. Because one can see, you know, the author's reason for talking about it, you know, because it discounts a rumor which he thinks is pernicious and dangerous, namely that Jesus' body was stolen. So you can see a reason why he might want to tell that story. And as I say, it's not just that there is a discrepancy between that account and what the others narrate, but there's also a contradiction in that in the others, they come to anoint Jesus' body, and the only obstacle that they're aware of is the size of the stone. Whereas in Matthew's, they can't think that they're going to come in because there's a guard there, and that's why Matthew changes the wording to they came to see the tomb. I think in balance it is more likely that that is not historical, that if you had a movie camera there, that you wouldn't see a guard. In addition to the fact that, you know, in this account, the Jewish leaders, they believe Jesus better than Jesus' own disciples did, right? Because they believe that, you know, something's going to happen in terms of it rising from the dead or the disciples claiming. Whereas the disciples in the presentation are all discouraged and have gone away. So again, but you know, this is, it's the sort of weighing, you know, the pros and cons that I think that you have to do. And I'm certainly willing to consider the possibility that it's historical. I don't think it's as likely that it's historical as that it's not historical. But it doesn't seem to me either that that is the essence of any of the accounts. The guard at the tomb, it seems to me that it's a fairly incidental detail. Believing or not believing in which isn't really going to change one's status, you know, the way in which one stands towards the bigger questions of, that are raised by these narratives.
I'm just going to ask each of the professors to just take somewhere between 30 seconds and a minute just to give us something to take away with us. And because you haven't spoken for a while, I'm going to start with you, Dr. Hamlet.
It's because nobody cares about my views. All right. I don't have a whole lot more to say, but I'll put it this way. I think there are good reasons to think that the disciples, I think we can easily get back to the disciples' experiences. The disciples had experiences which they thought were appearances of the risen Jesus. I think when we consider natural alternatives over against the alternative that they saw Jesus, I think the data are strong in terms of resurrection. I would punt to other events when people say, resurrection, something that incredible? I'd say, hey, listen, you need to take a look at near-death experiences that have been written up in medical journals with cross-validation. I mean, this is a huge subject, and if there's something to do that we might call afterlife, I don't think we can rule afterlife out as a meaningful category. And so I don't think it's like old David Hume says. I think David Hume fails inductively in his argument. I think he can't pull his argument off. So I'd say you can entertain the arguments pro and con. I think the argument is significant that the disciples were correct when they thought they saw the risen Jesus. I think the arguments for the empty tomb, I mentioned that this study from 75 to date has turned up 23 different reasons from critical scholars. I mean, it's a lot there. And I think the empty tomb is significant and is true. I don't think belief came from that, but I think it is belief. I think we can go all the way from truth to pastoral concerns, because I think if it's true, I think we do have a message to share. I think we do have a message to give to others. I think we do have reason to come along people who are grieving, who are suffering. And let me just end by citing Paul. I do think there's a world of difference between grieving with hope and grieving without hope.
I agree with that. I mean, I think that Christians do have a basis for hope. And I count myself amongst them. And I'm happy about that. I think, you know, the whole area that we've been debating is what is the relationship between that hope and historical evidence. And on that question, I think we have some pretty deep disagreements. And you know, I'm willing to say you're a Christian, and you're willing to say that I am, I guess. and I'm happy about that. And I also, you know, I appreciate the questions and, you know, some of the things that you've raised I need to think about some more. And at this point, for some reason, I think of a line from Bob Dylan about, I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues was all broken. And my tongue feels broken, so I'm going to hand it back to the silver-tongued Dean Wells.
I've got three things to say. First of all, to thank you, the audience, for the quality of your attention and the engagement and the questions. I want to thank the Socratic Club for enriching the life of this university and the surrounding region by putting on events of this kind, which I think are asking the questions, helping us all face the questions we're all asking. And in particular, I want to thank Dr. Marcus and Dr. Habermas, not just for the quality of their research and the way they're able to lay it before us in language we can all understand, but also for their willingness to make themselves vulnerable by showing their personal investment in the question, which is one of the most important that any of us face in our theological questionings. Thanks very much.